You're listening to episode 4 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, storytellers, before we get right into this interview, I'd love to thank Scrivener for sponsoring today's episode. Scrivener is a tool that helps writers bring their stories to life. I use Scrivener to gather all my thoughts, ideas, and research in an organized way that makes writing the chapters so much easier for me. Stay tuned for a featured interview with Ayo Petraka at the end of this episode to find out how he went from an avid user and dedicated fan of Scrivener to becoming the company's head of support and the founder's general right-hand man, and also what it's like behind the scenes of his job and how he uses the software for his own writing. Be sure to stick around right after the interview for the special promo code just for our tribe of storytellers. Hi, guys. We have a very, very special guest today. We have Tess Gerritsen with us. And oh my goodness, I've been such a huge fan of her writing and her novels for forever. And Tess, thank you so much for being here with us today and sharing all of your advice and your journeys with us. I'm so excited for them to meet you.
Well, thank you. I hope I can offer some advice and some help for those of you who want to be writers.
I just have to tell our listeners a little bit about your work. I actually read your book Harvest when I was 10 years old. I was having the most difficult time trying to understand all the medical jargon, but I was like, no, I've got to do this. This is such a cool cover on this book.
That was very advanced for a 10-year-old.
It was hard. It was really hard. I had to go back to keep reading and reading, and I kept trying to push myself. But let me tell you, I've never read anything like close to a character like Dr. Vivian Chow. And I think it's also being Asian American. It just really hit close to home. And I was like, wow, finally a really badass Asian American female character.
I have to tell you, she was based on a real person.
What?
Yes. I trained as a doctor in Honolulu, Hawaii. And one of our surgical residents was pretty much Vivian Chow. When she would operate, she'd have to stand on a stool. She was really gung-ho, scary kind of young woman. And when she would walk into the room, everybody would kind of back away because everybody knew this woman knew what she was doing and she was like a tiger.
I love that. You know what's funny? I'm not sure if you watched the show Grey's Anatomy. I actually caught a few episodes earlier on, but she kind of reminds me of Sandra Oh's character. I feel like maybe they were inspired by Dr. Vivian Chow from your book.
Years later, doctors who I knew in Hawaii, they read Harvest and they said, I know who that was. And they all knew exactly who I was writing about.
Oh, wow. I love that. I love that. Wait, so I know that you live in Maine right now.
Yes.
You're on the East Coast. I'm from New York, by the way. Holla to East Coast. Woohoo. What brought you out there?
I have a very geographically complicated life. I grew up in California. I got married to my husband who was from Hawaii, living in Hawaii. We lived there for 12 years. And I don't know if you've ever been on an island for a prolonged period of time, but after 12 years, I got what they call rock fever. I just felt trapped. You know, Hawaii is the most beautiful place on earth.
Yes.
But if you get in a car and drive around, you know, within like 8 hours, you're back where you started from. So I never felt like I could escape. And we went on vacation to Maine one summer with the family. It was gorgeous. It was beautiful. Yeah, and I just thought I could live here. So that's really how we ended up in Maine.
And it's funny because the weather is so different. It can get freaking cold up in Maine. I remember going up during the winters. Oh my goodness, it was freezing, like really cold.
It's really good for writers. I found that if the weather is really nice, like when I lived in California or Hawaii.
I want to go out and play.
Yeah, it was a constant distraction. Let's go to the beach. Let's have a picnic outside. Here, and you being a New York girl, know that when it starts to get dark around November and it gets cold, you want to stay indoors.
Oh, yes.
It forces you to kind of turn into yourself and to really focus on your work. And that's really when I work the best. I mean, I have had a really successful this past winter. I was really able to get a lot done. But now that I see that it's starting to get light again and summer's coming, I'm thinking, oh, this is almost the end of my work year. I could never write on the beach. That would be impossible.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your background with writing. I know you were in the medical field. I know you're right now a full-time author. But before that, I am a little curious. Were you writing when you were a doctor as well? And why did you choose the medical field when you were younger? Well, tell us a little bit about that. I think it's fascinating.
I knew I wanted to be a writer when I was 7 years old. And I told my parents that. Now, being an Asian American kid, you know, with tiger parents, my father said, being a writer is no way to make a living. You should go into the sciences. And I think that probably every Asian American kid hears that from their parents. Go into the sciences because of security. They're so focused on security, being recent immigrants. And I did what Dad said. So I went to medical school. It was not my first choice for a career. My first choice was always writing. Once I got into medical school, though, and then finished with my medical degree, I thought, I'll write on the side. And luckily, when I had my maternity leave, I had two kids who were really good at napping. Every time they went to sleep, I would sit down and write. And
what a blessing.
Eventually, I sold my first book. And I thought, well, I can make it as a writer. After all, maybe Dad was not right.
I love that you went forth and did that. But Tess, you've got to tell me, like, I don't believe this. You can't just be on a maternity leave and then, like, write all these amazing books that are New York Times bestseller. This is insane.
It took a while. Okay, it took
a while.
Oh,
my gosh.
And, I started off, and I know a lot of my mystery readers don't know this, but I started off writing romantic suspense novels. I wrote a total of 9 romance novels. They all had murder in them, okay? So I'm excusing my romance with murder, but that's really not the way I want to say it. I think I should have known early on that I was a thriller writer because my very first Harlequin book was called Call After Midnight. And I believe there were like 13 murders in that book. So that was kind of an unusual romance novel.
I didn't realize that you wrote romance novels. Like you mentioned, like your thriller fans may not know about it until I read your bio. And I was like, whoa, you wrote a lot of romance thrillers, like way before Harvest. I don't know why I kept thinking Harvest was the first book. So what drew you to write romance thrillers on your maternity leave and then segueing into thrillers?
Well, I was working as a doctor, and one of my patients was ready to leave the hospital. And as she left, she handed me this paper bag full of paperback novels, and they were all romance novels. And she said, I finished with these. They made me feel better. Maybe you'd like them. So I was going to take them to Goodwill. I had never really read romance before, and I started going through them out of curiosity. And I read one, and then I read another one, and within like 2 weeks, I'd read the whole bag of books. And this was while working 80 hours a week as a doctor. You know, I got hooked up romance novels. It was, at the end of the day, a stressful day. You pick up on these books and it's just like diving into a warm bath. Romance novels are fun. They're uplifting. There's always a happy ending. And there was something about them that made me really want to read more and more. So when I began to write, it was kind of obvious that I would choose the genre that I was enjoying. And since I always loved mysteries anyway, I just combined the two genres and did romantic suspense.
Oh, I like that. And where did your love for mysteries come from?
Oh, from Nancy Drew.
Oh my gosh, yes! I love that.
Every female mystery writer I know in America grew up with Nancy Drew. I mean, it's funny because I think it was like a couple decades ago, she was really put down by librarians as being, oh, that's not good fiction, or that's kind of like really base fiction. But I was inspired by Nancy Drew because when I was growing up, we didn't have women's lib then. Nancy was like the original feminist. She had her own car. She had her own boyfriend. She could stay out late at night. She didn't have a mom nagging at her because her dad was a widower, conveniently enough. So she sort of did everything that I wanted to do. And I think that it was not just the mysteries. It was just everybody wanted to be Nancy.
So how do you find inspiration for your stories?
Well, I have to say, I always start with what I call, or I hope to start with, what I call the punch in the gut, which is an idea that has a really powerful emotional resonance for me. I always start with, oh my God, and what happens next? And as an example, Harvest started with that really powerful emotional response. I had been having dinner with a homicide cop who had been traveling in Russia. He heard stories from the Moscow cops that kids were disappearing. They thought they were being kidnapped and sent off to the Middle East as organ donors, you know, cut open and their hearts and kidneys removed. I was so bothered by that because I have two kids and they would have been the right size to be organ donors then. And a couple of weeks later, I was still thinking about those children. And I thought, this is going to be my next book. And that was, I mean, it was clearly not a romance novel. So in a way, I would say my thriller career got started because I had that reaction to a story that I'd heard. And again and again, when I look at the stories that I've written, the ones that I think were the most powerful started off with the most powerful premise. Another example is, you know, I'm always looking for ideas or paying attention to what's happening around me. I read multiple newspapers. And one newspaper article I read was in the Boston Globe. It was about a young woman who was found dead in her bathtub. She had empty pill bottles. So the police realized it was an accidental overdose. They put her into a body bag and they sent her off to the morgue. And a couple of hours later, she woke up in the body bag. So one of those stories where I went, oh my God, and what happens next? How did this happen? And I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I thought, well, that's going to be a book. And it turned into a book called Vanish, where my medical examiner is working late one night. She hears a noise and she opens up a body bag and the woman inside is alive. So what's next? And my job as a writer is just to tell you what happens next.
Wow. I love that. I love that you can read and just be so observant, check on the newspapers and create an entire story from that. That's skill.
It's also being open to being aware of what you're feeling. I mean, I like to travel because I think a lot of my stories also come from experiences that happened to me while I'm away from home. You know, I have a book out called Die Again, and that was inspired by something that happened to me when I was on safari in South Africa. We had a little episode with a leopard in the bush where our bush guide really protected us. And I thought later, my God, we had to rely on him. We had to trust him. But what if he's not who he said he was? What if the guy who drove out to pick us up in the middle of nowhere from the plane was an imposter? And most dangerous creature in the bush walks on two legs. So that became the story, Die Again, about a group of tourists who disappear into the bush on a safari. I always think, always pay attention to what scares you. Always read newspapers, always listen to conversations, and always just be aware of your own emotions.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, why don't you tell us a little bit, because I know that Rosalian Isles is doing really, really well and is super successful. So congratulations on that. That's so exciting. The TV show is inspired by your books. Now, what inspired you for that book series?
You know, I started off, I was writing medical thrillers, and I had written this book called Gravity about the International Space Station, and was on tour when a woman said to me, I'm not interested in the space program. I wish you would write a book about something I am interested in. And I said, what's that? And she said, serial killers and twisted sex.
Oh my God.
And I had to ask her, what do you do for a living? And she said, I teach. What do you teach? And she said, the third grade. So,
oh my God, that's the best.
About third grade teachers wanting to have books about serial killers and twisted sex. And
you've got a huge market.
I said, there's a market here. And I sat down and I came up with the idea for a book called The Surgeon. It's about a serial killer who does really horrifying things to women. And it's a serial killer novel with twisted sex. Mm-hmm. But one of the characters I introduced in that book was a secondary character named Detective Jane Rosoli. She was not a major character. She was, in fact, supposed to die in that story. I imagine I was going to kill her near the end of the book. So I didn't bother to make her particularly likable. In fact, if you read The Surgeon, you will think of Jane as pretty bitchy, just not somebody you'd want to follow. But as I was writing the story, I got to like Jane. I realized she was an outsider. She's not an attractive woman in the story. The men are always overlooking her. She's a homicide cop, so she has to fight for respect. And you know, you and I, being Asian Americans, we know what it's like to be an outsider. Mm-hmm. There are many times when I was growing up, but I just never felt like I fit in, that I would never truly be accepted. And that part of my personality found its way into Jane Rosoli. By the time I finished that book, I couldn't kill her. She fought back. She survived that story. And I thought, oh, I wonder what happens to you next. Wow. I wrote the next book called The Apprentice, introduced a character there named Dr. Maura Isles, and got interested in her. So I wrote the third book called The Sinner. And before I knew it, I had a series. I never planned this out. It just happened very organically. And over the course of now it's 11 books, Jane and Maura have become friends. They certainly respect each other. They realize that the other gal is the best at what she does, and they want her to be the person they work with. So that's how the whole series started. It was never planned out. I never planned a two-woman series. And I certainly didn't realize it would ever go to television.
Do any of these characters resonate deeply with who you are?
Yeah, Maura Isles is me. Love Unfortunately, that. A lot of people think that Maura Isles is really boring. So I guess that's a reflection of who I am.
I don't think she's boring. I think she's the rock. You know, you need her.
Yeah, she sees the dark side of things. She is very logical. She's very scientific. She's a medical doctor. And in fact, I throw a lot of my own autobiographical information into Maura's life. She went to Stanford as an undergrad. She was an anthropology major. She went to medical school at UC San Francisco. That's all out of my life. The only thing is that, I mean, I've never had an affair with a priest. She has.
So, you're like, I just want to clarify that.
Yeah, I kind of feel that maybe the dark side, the quiet side of my personality personality, you know, shows up in more aisles.
I think it's so fun too, because there's things that maybe you've always wanted to do. And if you haven't done it, you can kind of live through that character that you created.
That is the big fun of
I know. It's like, you know, yes, I get that. To live so many lives, so many different lives.
In my writing career, I've got to feel like I've been an astronaut, I've been a surgeon, I've been a homicide detective, I've been an archaeologist. I mean, all
that's
these.
That's a crazy thing. Like, your writing is just so accurate. Your research must be so, I bet it's a lot of prep work.
It really depends on the subject matter. My most research heavy book was the book Gravity, which is about a female astronaut who's stranded aboard the International Space Station when the rest of her crew gets killed in a series of accidents. And, you know, in order for me to write that story, before I could know what goes wrong in space, I needed to know what is supposed to go right. I needed to know how normally things are supposed to function. And I remember pitching that story to my editor, and she was very excited. And she said, well, go ahead and write the book. And I thought, uh-oh. Now,
you're like, I just screwed myself over.
Yeah, now comes the hard work. I started off just having this story in my head, but not really thinking about what went into having writing it accurately. I wanted to write a book in which no NASA engineer would find a mistake. And that was a really challenging thing. So the first thing I do when I start my research is I read a lot. In that case, this was way in the sort of that beginning of the internet, I think. I started off buying a lot of books. I had a lot of aerospace medicine books. I did download thousands of pages from the NASA website. This was back before 9/11 when they had all this stuff on their website. You could find out how to fly a shuttle based on their website. And then eventually, after about 5 or 6 months of just reading about the space program, I needed to be there. So I approached Johnson Space Center. I called up their public affairs officer and said, I'm writing a book, a thriller that's set aboard the International Space Station. Can you help me? And he said, what goes on in your story? And I said, everybody on board dies except my heroine. And he said, do you know what the purpose of my office is here? It's to make my organization look good. And he said, what else goes wrong in your story? And I said, well, a shuttle crashes, killing everybody aboard. And he said, I don't think I want to cooperate. And I said, wait a minute. Everything that goes wrong in this story is not your fault. NASA does everything right. And he said, well, whose fault is it? And I said, it's the military's. And he said, when would you like to come?
Oh my God, I love that.
I spent a week at Johnson talking to everybody I needed to, the flight directors and aerospace doctors. And then I went to Cape Canaveral. I toured their mock-up of their ISS. And I was able to ask them really detailed questions about how to make things go wrong. It was unusual for them because they're not usually asked this kind of thing. I mean, you ask a NASA engineer, how do I make the shuttle crash? They kind of look at you like, but it was 2 years of research and writing to write that book, but it was the most fun I've ever had. I think by the end of having written Gravity, I was dreaming every night that I was weightless. That was how much it sort of seeped into my subconscious. It was almost second nature for me to know what it would be like to do something in weightlessness.
It's just insane because I know that with your research, and it took 2 years, and I'm here just sitting here quietly, like shaking my head in disbelief and with a huge smile on my face too, just seeing how your other books are so detailed, because with your medical background, it's everything is so precise.
The trouble is mistakes get through. And here's what usually happens is you don't know what you don't know. Right. And you will say something in a book and you just assume you're right. It doesn't even occur to you to look it up because you think you know the answer. And it turns out you're wrong. So those are the mistakes that usually slip through.
Have fans actually gone up to you and been like, oh, I noticed this little part is inaccurate?
Absolutely. You know, and this is why I'm very vague when I write about firearms, because people who know about guns, they are the ones who are always write you to say you got this detail wrong about this particular firearm. So, you know, I try to be either intentionally vague when I say she pulled out her weapon. Don't say she pulled out her Glock, blah, blah, blah. Because you'll make a mistake. But one of the mistakes I made was, it was a book called Bloodstream, and it was just a throwaway detail, and it had nothing to do with the plot. I was talking about this elderly man who had a 1944 Ford in his barn that had never been driven, and I got so much mail from people, from car
people. Are you serious?
Who said, don't you know they didn't make Fords that year because we were in the war years? It never even occurred to me. So those are the mistakes you make.
And that is so cool that they're actually reaching out to you and saying, hey, you know, on page 117, it's not true. But hey, thank you for even paying attention to that tiny little detail that I kind of threw in there. You know,
like,
I hope you took it as like a compliment.
I learn a lot from my readers, and they teach me a lot of things. Like in terms of the male-female breakdown of who reads me, I still have primarily female readers for most of my books, except for that book Gravity, which was mostly male for that book. It really depends on the subject matter. A lot of male readers won't read books by women. And I know this to be true because
I believe it.
I was in a bookstore once signing stock, you know, just signing copies of my book. And my publicist was with me and saw a man nearby picking up like armfuls of thrillers to buy. And so my publicist said, why don't you come and meet Tess Gerritsen and get a book signed? She's a thriller writer. And that man looked at me and said, I don't buy books by women. Now, here's what's interesting about it. I saw the titles that he was about to buy. And knowing something about the industry, I realized that two of the books he was about to buy had male names, but were ghosts written by women. It's one of these things where, you know, people have their prejudices. Men think women don't know how to write a good thriller.
You know, that really is sad. That's why I also was so impressed and so excited that you had so many male fans writing to you about that tiny little error. And it wasn't even that big of a deal. It's just such a little throwaway detail, but it just shows how invested those fans were. And they were men, you know, and that's awesome. And they knew you were female, so that's cool. Tess, let's talk a little bit. And I thank you so much for giving us those details. And I think that's so interesting. And let's get a little bit more personal. I want to hear, when was your proudest moment in your career?
You know, there are certain moments that stand out in your career. And the best one was the first time I hit the bestseller list. That is a really big thing in a writer's life. And it happened with Harvest, because I was on book tour and I was feeling really discouraged because I was there by myself in Cincinnati. And I had just gone through the airport and I'd stopped in the airport bookshop and there were no copies of Harvest in the bookshop. And I asked the bookseller there, I said, did you ever get copies of Harvest? And she said, oh, we had some, but I think they weren't sold, so we sent them back. So, you know, really discouraging. Oh, and I get to my hotel and I go to a book signing that night. And I think two people showed up. And it was like, you know, a moment where I think, well, I guess that's it. My career's over. And I got back to my hotel room. And this was before I had a cell phone. And there were messages on my hotel phone. And it was from my agent, from my editor, from my publisher, from my husband saying, guess what? You just hit the Times list tonight.
Oh, I just got chills.
So what did I do? I went down to the bar. I told the bartender that I just hit the bestseller list. And it was a woman. She was a law student who was also, you know, bartending. And she pulled out a bottle of champagne. She said, it's on the house. So I went back to my hotel room and I celebrated that night drinking champagne and reading the National Enquirer. So that was my big celebration. I will always have a soft spot in my heart for the National Enquirer because that was my choice of reading that night. There are several moments in life that always stand out. I mean, for me, it's like always the birth of my children. Those two things, yes. Like the highs of my life, and then hitting the bestseller list and just things that will always stick with you.
What's the best advice you can share with us?
Young writers always ask, well, what field of study should I go into? What's the best thing to learn to be a writer? And I always tell them, you know what? There is no field of study except just live a life, because so much of what you write about is going to come from your own life. You know, learn what it's like to fall in love, to get married,
yes.
To have kids, to have a job. That's what writing is all about. It's not about going and getting your MFA.
Listen, if you travel, even if you can't travel right now, but you're just observant, like we were talking about earlier, paying attention to what's out there in the newspapers or listening to what other conversations are going on in the coffee shop, it might inspire stuff. And you don't need an Ivy League education or any education. You know, it's really the school of life.
It's the school of life. It's paying attention. And it is having an inherent sense of, I guess, of empathy. To write a good character, you need to feel that character. You need to know what people are feeling. You need to have a sense of what their lives would be like, even if it's a fictional world. The other thing that I find very true for me, and I think a lot of other writers, is curiosity. You know, you ask questions. You're curious about a lot of different things. You want to know what's around the corner. And that has fueled a lot of my ideas, because I just happen to be reading about something that strikes my fancy. And I think at the end of it, wow, there's a book in this idea. I think it's important for people also to not stick to the old rule of write what you know. I mean, it's easy to write what you know, but write what you really want to know. If you want to know about oceanography, you're really fascinated by that, it'll be much more of a fun job for you to write that story. So, you know, explore things that even a big challenge, and maybe it's a space program or maybe it's archaeology, and have fun with looking up the research for that. But on the other hand, also know when to stop doing the research and just get started with the book.
Tess, I know with that, a lot of listeners probably felt like, okay, I've done a lot of that, but I'm feeling a bit stuck where I am. And if there's anything you'd like to share.
But you know, it's a function of how I write my books. I don't start off with an outline or synopsis. I just start off with that great idea and I start writing and I see where it goes. But what it means is that I end up writing myself into blind alleys all the time. Mm-hmm. Or I'll get 2/3 of the way through a book and I won't know who the bad guy is. For instance, with The Die Again, I think I got 2/3 of the way through and I thought, I don't really know who's doing this. And my solution to that is first of all, you have to stop riding because you're just spinning your wheels and you're getting frustrated. I find that there are a couple things that help get that aha moment. I mean, that's what I'm looking for, is the aha moment where everything becomes clear. Driving. I find that driving my car for long, boring distances really helps. I find that taking a long walk or lying on a couch and staring at the ceiling, there's something about going into, you know, alpha waves in your brain where you're not really thinking about the problem. You're sort of engaged in something really monotonous. And while you're engaged in this monotony, your brain is actually still working. It's actually still trying all these different solutions to the problem. And it will suddenly all comes together. And I find, for instance, I wrote that book called Vanish about the woman in the body bag. Well, it started when I wrote my first draft, it was a man in the body bag. And so the man gets sent to the hospital and then he kills a security guard and he takes hostages. And one of the hostages she takes is a very pregnant homicide detective, Jane Rizzoli, who's there to have her baby. And so it's, you know, it started exciting. The whole half of the book was, first half of the book was really exciting. And then I got right to the middle and I thought, I don't know what happens next. I don't know why this man is taking hostages. I don't know what his deal is, and I'm bored. And that's usually what happens. I get bored in the middle of my first draft. So I went through a long drive in Texas, and while I was there, I had this revelation. I thought, I know why I'm bored. It's because it's a guy. You know, who takes hostages in this world? It's always men. And they always do it for boring reasons. You know, they're either they're crazy or their wives left them or they have a political agenda. It's not interesting to me. But if it was a woman who took hostages, that's really different. That's really weird. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So I went home and I just kept on writing from that point on as if it had always been a woman who woke up in the body bag. And that's how Vanish ended up. It ended up being a female who takes the hostages. But what happened was that I realized halfway through that this was not very interesting to me and I needed to shake things up to make it interesting. That's what writer's block is about, is your subconscious telling you you need to shake things up. Somewhere in your deep in your brain, you know, our brains are amazing. It's kind of scary to me sometimes where things come from. The book that's coming out in October, it's called Playing with Fire, and it's not a Rizzoli and Isles series book, but I woke up with it. It was a nightmare. I woke up for the nightmare in Venice with this incredible idea, and I walked around Venice, and that day it all came together, but it all sort of arose from a dream. So I think writers should pay attention, especially to their nightmares. I mean, it's funny, I'm one of the few people that welcomes a nightmare because I think, there's a book in here.
How do you even remember your dreams, though? I feel like once I wake up, I'd forget everything. I mean, even when I'm awake, I still can't remember some ideas, like the ideas that would randomly strike throughout the day. So how do you remember your dreams and ideas overall? Do you jot them down as notes?
If it is really, really a, you know, a plot changing idea, I'll usually remember it. I have a file of possible ideas and I just put them in there because after a couple of months or a couple of years, you forget you had this idea 5 years ago, for instance. But sometimes when you're trying to start your next book, go through that file and think, oh, that was a pretty good idea. Maybe I'm ready to write this now. And sometimes ideas take a long time to come to fruition. I never throw anything away. Don't throw things away because I love paper. I'm sorry, but the digital stuff gets lost.
Yes.
Paper, I just feel like I hold on to.
Yes. And Tess, I have like a little dorky question. When you write, do you like writing with computers or do you have like a typewriter?
I even go further than that. I write my first drafts with pen and paper. I can type really fast. I can type like 100.
Oh, I'm sure.
But if I see it on the screen, I want to endlessly edit it and it stops me cold. So I use unlined typing paper. I can't have lines on it because I feel like it inhibits my creativity. So very often I'll just sit there with a ballpoint pen and paper, and that's my first draft all the way through. And then second draft, I will type it in myself. 25 books, it's been pen and paper. And, you know, I've tried again and again and again to write on a keyboard, and I just can't do it because I end up getting blocked. I want to, my editor turns on. And you can't, when you're doing your first draft, your editor has really got to be, an internal editor has to shut up because the first draft is really all about the story and
the ideas. Yeah, that's so true. What's your discipline like as far as your writing process goes? Is it like, okay, I'm going to write 5 pages on unlined paper every day?
Yeah, you write a little bit every day, and by the end of a year, you have a manuscript, and that's really what it's all about, is just being consistent. I keep an eye on the calendar is what I do. I know my deadlines are coming up, and I know how much time I have. So early on in a book, if I have a year ahead of me, I take, you know, I goof off a lot. It's doing your homework. You know, you wait till the night before. So, you know, I try to enjoy life, but if I'm in like a, you know, a period where I'm just trying to crank things out, I try for 4 pages a day. That's like 1,000 words a day. Mm-hmm. And if I can keep that up, then I, in 100 days, I should have a first draft.
And then so you transfer, you say your second draft, you transfer right. onto computer typing.
I type it into the computer and then I print it out and then I edit on paper again.
Oh my goodness.
If we ever went paperless, I'd be in trouble.
Oh my goodness. So how many drafts do you go through? Throw me an example. Let's say Rizzoli and Isles, like for each book, how many drafts generally do you go through?
You know, 5 or 6.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, the first draft is like a mess. The second draft starts to look like it's a book, but it really doesn't feel like it's ready to go off to my agent until maybe draft 5 or 6.
Okay, so talking about agents, I'm really curious about your take on how my listeners can get their books published. What would you advise?
If you have a finished manuscript and it is as good as you can make it, that's number one, is that it should be as good as you can make it. You have two choices nowadays. Things have changed a lot since I started off. Before, it was like traditional publishing was the way to go, but that is not necessarily true today.
Right, all the ebooks.
Mm-hmm. I come out of traditional publishing. That's where I'm comfortable. And that is the way you're going to get distribution in bookstores. So if that is your dream, then the way that I would advise is to get a literary agent, because that agent is going to be looking out for your interests. She'll be selling your book. She'll be making sure you get your money, and she'll be selling your subsidiary rights, like to film and to foreign markets.
Nice.
And the way I got an agent, I think the way most agents still get like to be approached is with a query letter or you can email it these days. And that's like a 1 to 2 page single space letter describing what your book is about. And that's going to be the most important, the most difficult writing you will ever do is that query letter, because you are trying to convey what your story is about and what kind of a writer you are. And if the agent likes that query letter, she'll ask to see the rest of your manuscript. If she likes your manuscript, she'll take you on as a client, and they take about 15% commission off everything that you earn. Mm-hmm. They're able to sell. I am incredibly happy with my agent. I've had my agents, she sold Harvest for me, and we've been together.
What? You've been with her since Harvest?
Yeah, we've been together since Harvest. And you know, the story that I have about a literary agent is that I remember at that time I was selling to Harlequin, and frankly, the advances for a Harlequin romance novel are somewhere between $5,000 and $8,000, which wasn't very much. And so here I had this new book, a medical thriller. Nobody knew I was a thriller writer, and I said to my agent, how much am I going to make on this? I'd be really happy if I got like $25,000. And her response was, if that's all we get, I'll shoot myself. And as it turned out, she got many, many, many times more for my advance. And wow. I would never have had that without a literary agent. So that's why I think a good agent can make or break your career. Now, if you don't want to go that way, and if in fact you've had a lot of rejections, mm-hmm. you can publish yourself. In the old days, it would have been like, oh, you'll never sell anything. But now you can directly publish as an ebook on Kindle or all these other markets for ebooks. And I have friends who are doing really well. They couldn't sell it any other way, but they are marketing themselves. They are independent authors and they are making a living. So that is an option today.
When you say your friends are doing really well, are these friends who already have a fan base that got into writing and were able to sell to their already pre-existing market?
Some of them were traditionally published, and so they had something of a following before yes. they went indie. But I know of others who just start off as indie and are doing fine.
Oh, so they built their empire from there. They built their fan base.
They built their empire, yeah, from the ground up.
Wow.
And that's more difficult to do. And, you know, it takes a really good business sense, which I can't say I have.
Which is why you have your amazing literary agent. There we go.
Right. And that's why I prefer to be traditionally published, because that's where I feel comfortable.
Nowadays, they accept email query letters. So it's nerve-wracking. You feel like it's make it or break it, and this is your only chance. Because, you know, you also hear nowadays that everyone emails, that it actually is awesome if you do send old school mail, snail mail, to really stand out.
I agree with that completely. I mean, email yeah? is easy and it's cheaper. But there's something about opening up a query letter on your desk and having the time to read it, having the time to think about it. Email for an agent, it's too easy for them to just say no online.
That is true.
But if they have two pieces of paper in front of them, they may linger on it a little more. So if I were given the choice, I would say use real paper and snail mail.
Now, having a literary agent, they are the ones taking care of reaching out to the publishing company.
Yes.
that how it works?
Yes, my agent, first of all, she negotiates the contracts with my publisher. She obviously tries to get as much money as she can for me. And when that book is sold, she helps me make some decisions like, are we happy with the cover they propose? Should we turn this cover down? Are you happy with this editor? Should we ask for a different editor?
Oh, okay. So you don't have to find your own editor.
Usually the editor who acquires it ends up being the editor who works with you. They work with you because they love that book enough to buy it for the publisher.
But gotcha.
Later on, if there are conflicts or their troubles with your editor or with your publicist, your agent is kind of the person in between who takes the heat for you. And later on, you know, when your books start earning, if there are royalties, the agent checks up and makes sure you're getting the royalties you should be getting. And if they feel that they're being withheld too much, they kind of nudge the publisher. The most important thing my agent does, though, I mean, besides career building, is they have developed my international market quite a bit. I mean, it's not just the U.S. We're talking about a huge market overseas. And I would say about a third to 40% of my income is from outside the United States.
What?
Yeah. So we all think, oh, America, that's, yeah, America is the biggest book market. But when you add up all the other countries combined, that's quite a bit of.
So just out of curiosity, because this is really exciting for me, outside of America, which is the next country that's your next biggest fan, like the biggest selling?
Probably.
I wonder if it's the Asian market.
No, it's not.
Oh.
My biggest market outside the U.S. is Germany and the U.K.
Oh, wow. Wow, so they love their thrillers.
They love their thrillers. The Dutch love the thrillers as well. Turkey is growing into quite a large market.
Really?
But it's mostly European.
That's really cool. I think those things are things that I'm not really aware of. So I just find them so interesting statistically just to see what really interests different countries. Now with Gravity, that's so different because it's space and NASA. What country outside of America? Is it still the European ones?
You know, I'm not really sure about Gravity. Gravity was an odd bird. First of all, the women readers dropped out of that book. They were not that interested in the space program. So the sales on Gravity were not as strong as I wish they had been. I'm not really sure where it did well internationally. I think probably Germany was a good place for it.
Now, I'm curious. I know that a lot of TV writers that I've talked to and directors, they all had mentors. I wonder with your work, it doesn't sound like you had a mentor, but how do you feel about mentors and how important do you think they are in playing a role in a young budding writer's career?
You're right. I didn't really have any mentors. I think I would say my mentors are books that I loved. Just being a reader, you learn a lot from the techniques of other authors. That was a big deal for me. I started off writing, I had a writer's group. I think that really helped. And the way we had our group structured was we kept it at four people max. So four people, four writers would meet once a week and we would read aloud from the work we had done the previous week. And we would hear their reactions. And I think that is really useful. You know, people that are not your family, somebody who's outside. And hopefully people who also write in either in your genre or write sort of similar stuff to what you're doing. I mean, don't get a poet in your writer's group. It doesn't
matter. Yes.
Or a historian.
It's very different.
Yeah. Get four fiction writers. Yeah, and that worked. I think I was in that group for maybe 8 years and really felt like I was developing as a writer because of that.
I think that's so specific to have four people who are all around the same writing level as you. It's almost like finding your soulmate. So how did you find such a specific group?
If I recall correctly, I think it was such a long time ago. How did we get together? I think somebody put a notice up in the local library.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, we sort of scoped each other out, and they were all university people. So two of them are faculty members who were trying to write novels. So I think we were pretty well matched.
That's really helpful to know. I think that would give some listeners ideas of where to scope out a great group. Now, Tess, what advice can you share with writers that could help them in their career or their lives?
I would say be open to every experience because you never know when it'll turn into a book. If you're offered a chance to travel, do it. Try to indulge your curiosity, really. I mean, if you're interested in one obscure topic, go ahead and do it. Follow up on that. And the other thing I would say is don't waste a moment because, you know, here I am I'm in my 60s now. I wish I had done more as a younger person. I mean, I just feel like I had a lot of wasted opportunities. And I would love to go back to school again. So remember always that life is short and you will have only a limited amount of time on this earth and really celebrate it.
At the end of the day, it's really about the memories you've collected and the people that you surround yourself with.
That's right.
You know, now talking about that, I would love if we could just talk a little bit about the importance of prioritizing family and hobbies. How do you juggle all that?
For writing, I don't wait for inspiration. You know, I sit down and I think, I've got to do this.
Okay.
I do it. But in retrospect, now that I am a fairly mature person, I look back at what were the highlights of my life. And it was really all about the children. If you have young kids, you're just going to have to realize that this is going to be a tough time as a writer, that you're going to have to write around them. But they will grow up. They will leave the house. And then you can completely focus on your writing career. But while they're young, you just learn to work around them. So I learned to work, you know, during the school day. When they were off at school, I would just sit down and get my work done. Or when I was like getting close to deadline, I would get up early and write while they were still asleep. That was a priority for me. As far as hobbies, you know, those are things that you do out of love. My big hobby was the fiddle. I mean, I love Irish music. And
I read that. That's so amazing.
I have friends who are musicians. But you know what? What's really interesting about that is that the book that's coming out in October is really, it's about a piece of music. And I was writing the book, and the book was describing this mysterious waltz that is found in an antique store. And I woke up one morning with a melody in my head. So I composed the music. It's going to be part of the package. When you buy the audiobook, you can hear.
Wow.
I composed. But see, that arose out of my hobby. So you think that a hobby is just for fun, but it turns out it's enriching all your brain cells, and it's doing something else. It's adding to your creativity. And you never know when that hobby is going to be part of your next book.
That's so exciting. I'm so excited to check that out, by the way. That's so cool. How long were you playing the fiddle when you were younger? Did your parents put you through a private tutor to learn that, or you picked it up yourself?
Oh, I had Asian parents. What do you think?
I was going to say, should I pull the Asian card? I'm like, or shall I settle down with that?
No,
I'm like, but you know, we all know how to at least play one instrument.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Well, I learned the piano and the violin when I was little.
Of course you did. Oh, my goodness. Of course.
College, and you don't up again. But I picked up again when my kids were young. So I had that grounding when I was a child.
Man, your kids are lucky. So they grew up with their mom playing the fiddle, like for fun, right?
Yeah. I mean, and they both know how to play their instruments. Now, they have put those instruments down and they haven't picked them up in a while. But I know that when they have children, they'll pick them up again because...
Well, when they were younger, you said that they played really well. So did you guys ever have like a family jam session where you guys played together? Like your
different instruments? Trios. We had,
that's so cool.
My older son plays violin. My younger son plays the cello, and I could switch back and forth between violin and piano with them. But you know what? They were boys, so it was like not as much fun for them.
That's so cool. And I'll also be sure to check out your book in October. I'm so excited for that. Is there a book that you love that you can recommend to our listeners to help them with their writing?
There is a book by Lawrence Block called Telling Lies for Fun and Profit. And that to me was one of the best writing books that was ever written. It's very down to earth. It's very practical. And I think it taught me a lot when I was first starting off. And I believe it's still in print, or at least certainly I can get it as an ebook. So have your listeners check that out.
We'll definitely have to check that out. Thank you for that, Tess. And I'd love to wrap it up with one final question. What are some small manageable steps that my listeners can apply to improve their writing?
It depends on where they are in the process. But I would say in every scene, introduce conflict and know what your character is feeling. Always pay attention to what they're feeling.
Freaking awesome. I love that. Tess, you've been so cool and so amazing. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Hey guys, here's a little snippet that didn't make it into the episode, but is an absolute must for foodies out there. Since Tess lives in Maine and I love lobster rolls, I couldn't help but ask about her absolute favorite lobster joint. Well, by the way, how good are the lobsters in Maine? Can we just talk about that for half a second? Because I'm such a foodie.
They are the best in the world. I think Maine lobsters are the best, first of all. I think they're sweeter. I think we really know how to cook them here. We have chefs who are very creative with lobsters. But I think the best thing about Maine lobsters is we have a very healthy fishery. And it continues to be healthy. The lobster catch keeps going up every year because we know how to preserve it. And that's a big push for the Maine lobster industry, that
so
we are
right
so
now.
Good
you
at
have
conservation.
No idea. I feel like I'm salivating and my stomach is gurgling right now. I'm like, I want some lobster rolls right now.
What's funny is that we people who live in Maine actually don't eat much
what?
Lobster because we're tired of it.
No way. I would be eating lobsters day and night, lunch and dinner. I don't care how many years I live there. I'll tell you right now. Since we're on this topic, really quick, what's your favorite restaurant or little spot where they have your favorite lobster rolls or any lobster dish in Maine that you could recommend to us if we ever visit?
Well, there's a really famous one called Red's Eats. It's down in Wiscasset. It is just a little stand, but if you go there in the summertime, the line goes around the block.
Oh my God.
And they're famous for, if you order a lobster roll, they give you like a pound of meat on your roll. So
what? And you know what? From what I remember, the prices were not bad too.
No,
because you guys are abundant with lobster.
Right.
So it's really not so bad. It's like, it's the same price in New York, but you get twice the amount. I that's from what I remember as a kid.
It's not, I mean, as expensive as people think of lobster, you know, as it's really not that expensive here in Maine. And the history of lobster is fascinating in that it used to be considered poor people's food. Because lobsters would sort of roll up on the beaches. Nobody wanted to eat it. If you were a school kid and you went to school with lobster in your lunch pail, they knew you were poor. So it was all about this big marketing campaign that told the rest of the world, hey, this is like caviar. And suddenly the rest of the world started to think, oh, lobster was a rich man's food. And that's really how the whole industry got started.
Don't even get me started with food, because I can talk all day and all night.
You know, that's because we're Asian. We do nothing but talk. I mean, we think about when we've eaten breakfast, we think about what's for lunch. When we've eaten lunch, we think about what's for dinner. That's just the way we are.
Hey, Storyteller Tribe, how awesome was Tessa's episode? I still can't believe she wrote all 25 of her books with pen and paper for the first draft. If you'd like to thank Tess or want to know about her latest work and say hello, find her on Facebook and Twitter at Tess Gerritsen. And a huge thank you to Tess for being so generous with her time and all of her really helpful takeaways. For links to the books and resources that were brought up in Tess's interview, be sure to head over to Tess's show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Tess Gerritsen. As mentioned at the top of this episode, I'd love for you to get to know the team behind Scrivener. We have Io Petraca, the head of support and the founder's general right-hand man, with us today to talk a little bit about Scrivener behind the scenes. What's your writing process like?
My writing process, I am old school. I go out with a notebook and a pen, and I just sit and write. It doesn't matter where it is, a park bench, a coffee shop, or a bookstore, or an airplane, or a train. It just doesn't matter. I always have my notebook, and I always have my pen. And when I get back home, I type it up, and that's when I kind of reiterate and think about what I wrote initially. I expand on it and change it. I just like the whole process of starting with something that takes manual effort to produce and then turning it into something digital.
That's really awesome. Are there any cool or neat little tricks or features that we might not be aware of that we should probably check out?
Well, one thing that comes to mind that is a personal favorite of mine is the ability to take several different pieces of text from your manuscript or whatever you're working on and view them together in one text editor. Because the way Scrivener works is it lets you cut up your work into tiny pieces so that you can have a better view of what you're working with. So kind of like a table of contents. And then you can just go and view those little pieces together as one single chunk of text, no matter how much you cut it up. And that flexibility of being able to jump between a small piece that's very topical or one scene, if you know you're working on fiction, being able to view several different scenes together that all have to do with one character, maybe, no matter where they come from in the book.
You guys are so cool. You guys have so many awesome features. It's like, I feel like every time I'm finding new things over and over again, I'm like, what? Where did this come from?
There's a lot to it. We like to say that it's the kind of thing you can jump into, but you're going to be learning it for a long time because there's so many new things that you can do, new ways to combine features, that type of thing.
That's awesome. That kind of sounds like the best relationship ever. It's like, okay, you know it's an awesome thing, but then you jump in, it's like, whoa, it's even better than I thought every single time. So that's really cool. So I'd love to know how you got involved with Scrivener.
So have you ever heard of National Novel Writing Month?
National Novel. Oh, is that NaNoWriMo?
Yes, NaNoWriMo. I used to do that quite a lot. And there was one year, 2005, there was a post on that forum, the NaNoWriMo forum, about this new program for the Mac for writers. And I had to check it out. So I did. And I got in touch with the writer of the software. And it was Keith. That's where it went from there. We just, you know, started bouncing ideas back and forth. I really love the software. So I ended up spending a lot of time on the forum talking with other people about it.
So you actually started off as a fan.
Yes, I started off as an avid user.
That's so freaking cool. I love hearing that. I assumed that you learned about Scrivener after you got the job. I didn't realize it was the other way around.
Oh, yes. No, I was quite enthusiastic a user. I had thousands and thousands of posts and even wrote the original FAQ for frequently asked questions.
That's really amazing, actually. I think that's really cool when you get to wake up every single day working for a company that you love.
Oh, I can't even imagine a better job. really.
So Ayo, I'd love to know a little bit about what it's like working with the Scrivener team.
Yeah, well, that's a part of what I really love about this job is the fact that because we're all scattered around the world and we all are basically freelance for the company, we can just work freely. And for me, I almost kind of just drift in and out of work throughout the day as I have time to. You know, I wake up in the morning and I check my email and I go through things and I have breakfast. And then I go and I do a solid, you know, few hours of just getting some good work done and going through the design emails and writing about the software and helping people on the forums. And then I take another break. And then in the afternoon, I'll do some more. So, you know, I kind of just fit it in throughout my day and just love being able to have that kind of freedom to do what I like as much as I like.
Man, that's the life. I really love hearing that. I love knowing that this brand that I am such a fan of also has such a great model set up for their employees. So Ayo, thank you so much for your time. And that wraps it up, guys. As you can see, I'm so proud to partner with Scrivener as I really do believe in them. And if you haven't used them yet, I really encourage you to download their free trial and check it out for yourself. I want this tool to help you as much as it's helped me. So if you decide that you do love it, Scrivener has a very special offer just for our storyteller tribe. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Scrivener and enter promo code 88cupsoftea at the checkout page for a 20% off discount. And last but not least, thank you guys so much for tuning into my 4th episode. It would mean a lot to me if you take action with the advice and tips that Tess was really generous to share. I want to see you moving forward in your career because your success inspires me. So let me know what really hit home with you for this episode. And if there are any questions you'd like for me to ask future guests, head over to Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram and find me at 88 Cups of Tea. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!